From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. I'll talk with Joshua Landis about rebel advances in Syria and new Saudi aggressiveness in its conflict with Iran.
Once again, the Saudis and the Turks are trying to use the Islamists to get their own ends, thinking that they'll be able to push them aside when it's all over.
Then I'll talk with cultural scholar Sebastian Hajduszke about East German films American audiences would have recognized.
Westerns, science fiction films, love stories, pretty much anything you can think of.
And then OU German professor Bob Lemon explains how that changed with the advent of socialist realism.
And often in literature, it's sort of dismissed as boy meets tractor.
Film and literature behind the Iron Curtain. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Joshua Landis, welcome back to the studio. And we're going to take advantage and get an update on Syria. So we've been hearing that Assad is, this is the beginning of the end for him. Maybe this is exaggerated. I don't know. This is what I want to know. But he's lost some big territory. He's lost a couple of big cities in the north. The rebels seem to be gaining ground. Why is that?
Well, it's absolutely true. Two big cities, Idlib, a provincial capital in the north near the Turkish border, and Cizre just below it, major victories. And al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda wing in Syria, has led the charge with a whole panoply of other militias that have now seemed to have surrounded it and are taking its leadership from it. So the militias are much better organized and more powerful in that sense. But we also believe that Assad is weakening. He's running out of Alawites. The Alawites are a small minority. That's his power center. They're only 12% of Syria, and maybe as close to 100,000 Alawite young men have been killed. There are only less than 3 million Alawites in Syria. So it's taken a real toll. The other religious minorities that have normally supported him don't want to send their kids out to the front. They're getting killed in big numbers. So the Assad regime seems to be weakening. The rebels are getting much better coordinated. But there's also an international dimension to this as well. The Saudi king, new Saudi king, Salman, came onto the pot just a few months ago, and he has revolutionized the regional status quo because his predecessor, King Abdullah, was very cautious, and he was much more worried about Islamic fundamentalists than he was about Iran in many ways. He'd been worried about the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. He supported Sisi, and that led him to be fearful of joining Turkey and Qatar in really backing up these Islamist forces. But this new king, he has prioritized getting rid of Assad, hurting Iran and Syria, even at the price of arming Nusra and these Islamist militias. And that means that he, Turkey, Qatar are on the same page, giving more weapons, more money. Because Saudi Arabia is at war in Yemen, it's a much higher priority now because they believe they're at war with Iran and Yemen, and they want to bleed Iran in Syria because Iran is the main backer of Assad, supporting with troops, advisors, money.
Well, this is quite an interesting development with Saudi Arabia. We talked a few weeks ago about the war in Yemen that they're engaging in, but that they've got this greater kind of regional purpose. But the U.S., meanwhile, does what? I mean, it's standing by. It's engaging. It's arming. It's supporting. Saudi Arabia is an ally. So where does the U.S. stand in all of this?
Well, this is a leading from behind routine, I think. President Obama did not want to get engrossed in the Middle East, and he's urged both Turkey and Saudi Arabia to take a much more forward role in this, and now they're doing it. And in a sense, you have to be a little bit worried about what you wish for sometimes because the United States is helping Saudi Arabia in Yemen, giving a lot of advice and helping with targeting. But we haven't mentioned anything in Syria, and this is – the potential is that this will help the Islamists and al-Qaeda in Syria. Once again, the Saudis and the Turks are trying to use the Islamists to get their own ends, thinking that they'll be able to push them aside when it's all over. But we've done that before in Afghanistan and in Iraq. So it raises the question of what will this use of power and Saudi aggressiveness really accomplish in the Middle East?
Well, it doesn't sound like we have any good options.
It doesn't. We don't have good options, and we've been worried about not doing enough. And here is somebody coming along willing to do a lot more. So we'll see how it ends up.
All right. Well, Joshua, thank you very much once again for this update and your always useful insight. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you might have. Send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzette Gralat and at Joshua_Landis. You can also leave your comments on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org. While you're there, you'll find a link to Joshua's daily blog, Syria Comment, as well as instructions on how to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. After a short break, I'm joined by two scholars of German literature, film, and culture to discuss how media in East Germany evolved over the first few decades of the Cold War. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. Today I'm joined by two guests who focus on German culture in the 19th and 20th centuries. Sebastian Heiduschke teaches courses on language, culture, and society at Oregon State University in Corvallis, and his research examines East German cinema during the Cold War. Bob Lemon is an associate professor of German here at the University of Oklahoma and studies literature in the 19th and early 20th century German Empire. Bob Lemon and Sebastian Heiduschke, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, the both of you have a background in the Germanic parts of the world, and Sebastian, for you, particularly in East German cinema, and Bob, for you, literature. But let's start first with you, Sebastian, and talk about East German cinema. Because, well, first of all, let's remind ourselves that East Germany used to be a separate country, even though it's East Germany and West Germany came back together now almost 25 years ago. They still, you know, are known for the cinema, the film that they produced during their time, the GDR. So can you tell us a little bit about some of those defining characteristics of East German cinema and how it might be distinguished from other German cinema, other German films?
Right. So I think the interesting part about East German cinema is that it starts in 1946 before the country East Germany actually launches. So the country was founded in 1949, but East German cinema starts in 1946. So there were films made for that cinema before we actually had the nation state in place. And it ends in more or less 1994, so 4 years after unification. So it's kind of, I guess that's the most interesting part about it, that it starts before and ends right after that. And it's not necessarily what we would think of a communist or a socialist country, especially in the beginning. The films were pretty much what we would expect from West German movies. So very entertaining musical comedies, melodramas, and so on. And that kind of drifts away in the late 1950s and then especially in the 1960s once the wall goes up. So that's really the most defining moment once the interaction between West German filmmakers and East German filmmakers stops. That's when the East German cinema becomes a cinema in its own right. And that's when it becomes more political. So that's when it supports the agenda of the nation.
So do you find the same phenomena, you think, Bob, in literature, that you have this kind of distinction between kind of very entertaining, you know, literature that then becomes quite political after that political divide is, I guess, memorialized in the wall?
Well, you have an official kind of credo, an official kind of system of how you're supposed to depict the GDR, and that's called socialist realism. And often in literature, it's sort of dismissed as boy meets tractor, which is the idea that you're supposed to show how the socialist system is growing and how society should progress into the future. But of course, over time, writers work within that system, they negotiate that system, and they develop their own interests. So you have major figures coming out of East Germany like Christoph Wolff, who was obviously celebrated as much in the West, perhaps even more so than in the East. And you have also dissident voices that continue to be contrary, even after the wall has come down. So I've been working on a poet called Volker Braun, who, as a sort of true believer in socialism, was convinced that when the Monday demonstrations started in Leipzig, that that would lead to a proper people's revolution, and was bitterly disappointed when the West, in his view, sort of colonized the East and just came in and took over. And so I've been looking at poems that he wrote actually at the time the wall came down. And he is moving from euphoria to disillusionment in the space of really just a year or so. And so he could see where this was going at the time. And if you look at sort of East German literature, I think it still has remnants even now, even 25 years later, you see that divide culturally between two peoples who've had very, very different histories and very brought up in very different systems and different traditions.
So what are some examples? I mean, you mentioned a couple, a poet, for example, but what are some additional examples of authors and film that we could even, you know, refer to in terms of that real, you know, cultural difference in East Germany?
Well, there's a text that I teach, which is from the 1970s, called The New Sufferings of Young W. And it's actually a sort of extended riff on a very old classic work of German literature by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. And in the original, we have a young man falls in love with a woman who's engaged, and he ends up committing suicide out of love for this young lady. And in the updated East German version from the 1970s by Ulrich Plenzdorf, our hero is equally an alienated young man who goes to sort of live in this small holiday home just outside Berlin. He's sort of squatting there. And he ends up sort of expressing the alienation of his generation in sort of very groovy 70s language. So that was a kind of work where you could see that all the problems that we associate with youth, say, in the West, sort of alienation, a feeling of conflict with the older generation, were absolutely being experienced on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And it was one of those works that came out in a period of liberalization in the early 70s that meant that those in the West could suddenly identify with those in the East, and they could all share their obsession with music and jeans or whatever. And there's a sort of sense in which for just a brief moment in that period, the two countries had similar interests, at least amongst the youth. So a work like that would be very a very useful way of sort of getting into East German culture in a way that isn't so alien to a Western audience.
I think there are a bunch of films that come to my mind, and but what I like to distinguish are the films that were made for political purposes, so the for agitation and propaganda purposes by the party, and then films that were made for entertainment purposes. So I think it's usually surprising to hear that the genre film in East Germany had things like westerns, science fiction films, love stories. I mean, pretty much anything you can think of. Also very critical films, films that were so critical of the government that the government, you know, they allowed a certain point of criticism, but then had to intervene up to the point that they had to ban films. So in 1965, they had to ban the entire production of that year because it was too liberal. It was like the French New Wave cinema that criticized East Germany and the state of East German cinema at that point. But films that come to my mind, if we were to talk about political films, I would probably use Kurt Metzig's Ernst Thälmann films. It's a two-part film, a biopic about a leader of a work movement in the Weimar Republic, so in Germany of the 1920s. That's on the political side. And then for other films, like I said, the what was called the Indiana film, the westerns, it's a series of 12 and some say 14 westerns that look at the life of the Native Americans just in kind of from a reverse angle, so out of the perspective of the Native Americans, you know, the struggles of the Native Americans. Or science fiction films that bring out the accomplishments of international solidarity. So a space crew that consists of many races and, of course, all of the genders. And so we have all of that in these films. And I think that's a lot of the time very surprising.
That's Sebastian Hajduszke, and I'm talking with him and University of Oklahoma professor Bob Lemon about how cinema and literature in East Germany evolved as the Cold War went on. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I've been talking with Bob Lemon from the University of Oklahoma and Sebastian Hajduszke from Oregon State University. When we left off, Hajduszke described several genres of film that were unique to East Germany both before and after the Berlin Wall went up. Well, Sebastian, you also run a program called the Dark Side Cinema, which provides free film, access to free film for students. Tell us a little bit about this and the importance, it seems to me, that you're expressing about students watching film.
Mm-hmm. The Dark Side Cinema is an independent movie theater, privately owned movie theater in Corvallis, Oregon. And what I did is I partnered up with that cinema to give students and also community members the experience of going to the movies and watching movies the way we really want to watch movies. So I take students to the movie theater to get the smells, the sights, the sounds, but then also we look at projection equipment, you know, things that we sometimes don't think of when we teach film or when we talk about film, and so they get the hands-on experience. The free film screenings are a service to the students and also to the community. We are a small college town. And I think it's important for the university and the community to get along because we coexist in the town. And so having these free screenings is one way to connect with them. The screenings are usually recent releases. A lot of the time we have premiere screenings. We have huge film festivals for such a small community. We partner up with like major television stations in Germany who bring in their films. We have a cooperation agreement with the Portland German Film Festival. So it's just a way of making sure that students and that community members can experience the joys of cinema.
The joys of cinema, for sure. As a film buff myself, I love to watch film, and we do so for many, many different reasons. But I think one of the things that we get from film, and it sounds to me like both of you are dealing with this, and as well, you know, through literature, is that we learn things. We learn about substantive issues, whether they're political issues, that film and literature are rarely just entertaining. They actually have a message, or they have something that they can teach us. So is this also kind of a motivation in how you use film? I mean, both of you are obviously in a university setting teaching about film. It's not just about filmmaking, but what you can express through film. And I think I hear both of you talking about connecting through film and literature and sharing identity through film and literature, that those are really important things that we can do in society. Is this also part of what you do?
I think you're right. It's that's one part of it. But I think more important is for students to understand that films are never a depiction of reality. So we can extract information from these films, and we always have to make sure that we put on our, you know, the critical lens is what I think was what is important for me, that students do not just passively watch these films, but they begin to ask the questions afterwards and to criticize, to say, you know, I don't think reality was the way we see in these films. You know, that's when I think that my work is more or less done. You know, once they start asking the questions and begin to question also the medium of film, that's when I think we are where we need to be.
Same for literature, you think, Bob?
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm teaching the senior thesis capstone course at the moment, and we're dealing with the film The Lives of Others, which is a very famous film that depicts the East German Stasi, the secret police. And my students, as they watch the film and then find out about the historical reality, and they start questioning how the film portrays, for example, the Stasi spy who sort of regains his humanity in the process of observing a particular couple, then I think that's ideal, that they actually start criticizing and thinking critically about the images that they're seeing on the screen, and whether this is perhaps a sanitized version of reality, or whether it actually does show that even under that system, humanity could in some ways be flourish and be reborn.
Well, I have to ask in the little bit of time we have left about comparing American film with German film, and how Germans are depicted in American film and how Germans might perceive that. I mean, I think that that's something, you know, when you mentioned Christoph Waltz, for example, earlier, I mean, these, yes, you know, always playing the bad guy almost, right? You know, so how can you compare the two, and how do we perceive each other through our film?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, but I think it's Germans are typecast like any other, I guess, nationality. You know, you need the blonde German, or in the case of Christoph Waltz, he has become that very typical German or bad guy who will play. So I think it's not just a matter of being German, but being of a different nationality, and you always get put into, you know, into one of those drawers. Oh yeah, the German is the Nazi, or I don't know, the... I can come up with another nationality right now. So I think that's just a trait of Hollywood cinema. And since you, Bob, since you mentioned the Lives of Others, I think that's also what's happening there, that that film was made for an international audience.
Absolutely.
And with the goal in mind to compete for the Academy Awards. And I mean, it did that very successfully, but that's all there is to it.
Absolutely. I think as an Englishman, I can identify with the stereotyping. And of course, I think
well, the bad guys always have the British accents.
That's
too, right?
Because right? So, they're suave, yeah, and sophisticated, yeah, right. And that means evil, I think, for an American audience to an extent. But I think the German experience of being typecast will be changed, at least as we have German actors coming to appear in Hollywood films as opposed to Anglo-American actors doing German accents.
Well, very interesting, Bob. And Sebastian, thank you so much for being with us today to share your insight about film. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Bob Lemon and Sebastian Hajduszke about film, literature, and culture in East Germany during the Cold War. There's more information on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, Symphony Swift oversees our research and books the guests, and Sam Dupre writes a lot of our content for the web. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Berlott.